an effective cleanup mechanism, you would have to be able to use it. That's going to be very difficult in the Arctic.
Debating oil spill cleanup capabilities in the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 18th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new age exercise machine for sled dogs.
A treadmill that can house, 16 or 18 dogs at one time could come in handy.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Shell Oil has released a preliminary report on a real-world test cleaning up oil in the Arctic. The test was conducted in May in the Barents Sea north of Norway. It was funded by six oil companies, including Shell, and carried out by a Norwegian research institute called SINTEF. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
How difficult would it be to clean up an oil spill in the Arctic? It's one of the biggest looming questions as companies consider offshore drilling plans in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas above Alaska. According to the new report, the answer is not as hard as you might think. Sue Moore is Shell's Alaska Operations Manager.
The preliminary results clearly indicate there are a suite of tools and techniques that are effective in responding to oil spills in Arctic conditions.
Those tools include booms to contain the oil and help light it on fire, skimmers to scoop up the oil, and dispersants. Moore says one of the most exciting findings of the report was the effectiveness of dispersants in Arctic waters. She says they're like a mild soap.
To disperse oil droplets into very small droplets in the water column such that they are easily biodegradable.
The report also shows that oil can be easier to clean up in the Arctic because ice acts as a natural boom containing the crude. That's a point the North Slope Borough agrees with, even though the borough has been highly critical of offshore drilling plans. Harold Caron, chief administrator for the North Slope Borough, attended Shell's presentation of the report. He says other specifics were hard to come by. He asked for many details that the study's authors weren't willing to elaborate on.
And that's one of the weaknesses of what was presented, and they repeated that to questions over and over and over again.
Shell says they'll be able to comment more extensively when the full report comes out next year. The North Slope Borough would like to see similar testing performed in Alaska waters. Curran says the Norwegian study fails to demonstrate how oil can be cleaned up in a wide variety of ice and weather conditions, an important factor in the Arctic.
In storm conditions, I'm not sure that there will ever be technology to be able to clean up oil.
There's also the long season of darkness to consider. Michael Levine with Oceana wonders about that issue.
Even if you had an effective cleanup mechanism, you would have to be able to use it. And that's going to be very difficult in the Arctic.
Other environmental groups were also skeptical of the report. Whit Sheard with Pacific Environment in Alaska says it's great to see the oil companies working to develop new technologies to clean up spills in the Arctic. But he calls any oil drilling in the Arctic extremely risky, no matter what tools are available.
And I think a lot of us have come to the conclusion that considering how risky it is, the changes that are occurring in the Arctic environment, and what may occur to subsistence communities who will lose access to their resources, that we can't prevent these spills yet. So being able to slightly clean them up better does little to alleviate our main concerns.
Shell executive Susan Moore is sympathetic to environmental concerns. She says oil companies are spending a lot of money to be able to clean up oil spills, but they recognize the best response is prevention. Sheard counters that a big mess is guaranteed if the oil companies drill in the Arctic. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Obama administration is giving Shell Oil Company more time to respond to comments on its proposed drilling plans for the Chukchi Sea. The Minerals Management Service is considering Shell's 2010 development plans. Today, the agency said it will give Shell 10 extra days to weigh in. MMS spokesman Nicholas Pardee.
We wanted to give Shell some additional time to respond to the comments, but we did ask Shell to provide it quickly, within 10 days. so its responses can be considered in the review of the exploration plan.
Pardee says MMS should announce its decision on Shell's proposal soon after, likely in early December. Shell says it wants to drill one or two exploration wells in the Chukchi Sea next year. A previous plan by the company was rejected in federal court. Environmentalists and Alaska natives living in coastal villages oppose Shell's proposal to drill wells. They say it could harm marine mammals, which are crucial to subsistence, and worry there's not proven technology to clean up oil spills in icy water. Last month, MMS gave initial approval to Shell for its drilling plan in the Beaufort Sea, with the caveat that the company must meet certain environmental requirements. Development of a pipeline to export Alaska's North Slope natural gas is on track. That was the word from state and federal officials who held a meeting in Fairbanks last night to update the public on the project. State Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin said a line to Canada or Valdez remains viable.
The large capacity gas line project is alive and well, contrary to some reports that you may hear otherwise, that the long-term price expectations in North American natural gas market still support this project, even with the advent of new gas supplies that we hear a lot about in the news. It doesn't change the expectation for the economics of natural gas in the 10 years plus that this project is focused on.
Galvin said the major gas line projects, the state-licensed pipeline being pursued by TransCanada and Exxon, and the independent line under development by BP and ConocoPhillips will both hold open seasons for shippers to bid on capacity next year. The current consensus is that any bids that come in during the initial open season will be conditional, dependent on resolution of fiscal certainty issues like state taxation and the cost or tariff charged shipping gas on a pipeline. State Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Tom Irwin said everything hinges on the tariff.
It has to compete in the world market. Whether it's the United States or LNG, we have to compete. How do you compete? Low tariff. You have to have a low cost to move that gas down the line.
Irwin said the $500 million the state is giving TransCanada under the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act agreement will help lower the tariff by reducing upfront costs. State Representative Jay Ramris of Fairbanks says there's no way an Alaska project can compete given the recent advent of massive shale gas production closer to urban centers.
There are thousands and thousands of miles of transmission line and infrastructure right above the gas, and the cost of moving that gas can be 7 cents, 15 cents, 40 cents to move it to existing markets. And I think that the rosy picture that was painted tonight by the commissioners looks good in Fairbanks when it's 30 degrees below zero and we all want to put on rose-colored glasses, but it ignores the economic realities that are facing us today.
State commissioners contend that growing population and energy demand will support more expensive Alaska gas by the time it's available. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a religious curiosity from Alaska's past.
Trampling the Shaman, Disease, Guns, Money, Booze, John Muir, and the Conversion of the Chilkats.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision. People with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
When people find themselves without shelter, a myriad of problems pop up, and those problems can be magnified when homelessness strikes youth and families. As KCAW's Ed Ronco reports in the second of a three-part series on homelessness in Sitka, dealing with homeless youth is all about providing stability as soon as possible.
To really understand what homelessness can do to young people, spend a minute listening to Phil Burdick, a teacher at Pacific High School.
One of the first things you're ever taught in education is about Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Maslow's hierarchy of needs is a list, basically, of the things people need to survive. But here's what you need to know. It's usually represented by a pyramid with physical needs, things like food and water, at the bottom. And right above that, safety needs, shelter, physical security, health. Way up at the top are the things you need to use in school, creativity, problem solving, acceptance of facts. And just like a real pyramid, the bottom is the foundation for the top. Take it away, and things fall apart. In other words,
if a student doesn't have a safe place to live and doesn't have food to eat and doesn't feel cared for, then they can't learn. You just can't.
And Burdick says if you can't learn, you get further behind, and then your options in life are limited. So Pacific High School tries to interrupt that cycle. Every Friday, it teaches life skills such as consumer math and job skills and building healthy relationships. And they offer food. Well, most schools do. But Burdick says at Pacific, it's a little different.
We serve breakfast. There's food available all day. There's hot tea. We have a lunch program where the students cook lunch. So they learn nutrition. They learn how to take care of themselves. Most of our students, if not, I'd say 75 to 80% of our students stay for lunch and eat with us so we have a sense of community. They feel safe.
Of the 39 students at Pacific High, Burdick says probably 10 to 15 experience some form of homelessness, usually in the form of what's called couch surfing, living with friends as long as they can stand you and then moving on to another friend's house. There's another program in town trying to make sure teenagers don't have to couch surf.
Hello.
How are you doing?
When you walk into Sharon Stitz's office, you're greeted by a big, comfortable couch, an old easy chair, and a cushioned rocker. Stitz runs the Transitional Living Program for Youth Advocates of Sitka. They take young adults from age 16 to 21 who are in unstable housing situations and place them with host families. Some teens are referred to the program through schools or even from their own families, and some just show up at Stitz's office. She's seen kids go on to get vocational certificates or to find work. A few are planning to attend college.
And they're seeing how healthy families live. So many of these kids come from unhealthy or dysfunctional families. And it's the first time they're in a family that doesn't, you know, fight all the time and actually has dinner together and does fun family things together. And it's just really neat to see these kids blossoming.
Right now, 16 youths are placed in 10 different homes. There are 15 host families signed up in the program, which is funded through a federal grant. The grant expires in about 3 years. Stitz and YAS Executive Director Annette Becker say they're trying to figure out how to fund the program once money runs out. Maybe another federal grant. Maybe something else. In a perfect world, their program wouldn't be necessary at all.
In a perfect world, you'd have perfect parents. And that doesn't happen. A lot of parents are struggling, too. And there's a lot of substance abuse in families, domestic violence, and a lot of our youth are exposed to that. In a perfect world, that wouldn't happen, but that's not reality.
The reality is that families find themselves without shelter for any number of reasons. One of them is domestic violence. And when that's the reason, the women and children in the family often find their way to a big blue house on a hill near downtown Sitka. This is the home of SAFE, S-A-F-V. It stands for Sitkins Against Family Violence. 8 women and 8 children are in the house on this Monday afternoon in late October. Many of the women who come here are escaping a domestic abuse situation, but not all of them, says Acting Director Vicky D'Amico.
We believe that even if they present with simply a housing issue and not immediate safety, that they are at risk simply by living in their car or being homeless. And we want to prevent them from any kind of unsafe situation, living out on the street or living out in the woods or at Indian River or wherever they camp.
SAFE has 25 beds. D'Amico says they also have a waiting list.
It sure would be nice to have enough room or the facility to let everyone who needs to come here.
You kind of have to triage things.
We absolutely do.
For needs of a less urgent nature, low-income housing programs try to provide shelter for families who need it. The Baranof Island Housing Authority, or BHA, runs 146 housing units, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has vouchers that some landlords accept. It also runs 24 apartments for families. Between a third and a half of those residents come from homeless situations, and 60 people are on the waiting list for those apartments. But Brian Massey of Alaska Housing says the rules can complicate things. The federal government has specific definitions for what exactly homeless means. Those couch-surfing teenagers we mentioned earlier, federal government says they're not homeless. This is Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
Naturalist John Muir played an unlikely role in converting Chilkat Indians to Christianity during the 19th century, according to Haines-based writer Dan Henry. Accompanying a missionary to Chilkat territory, Henry says Muir became known as the Ice Chief and appealed to the Chilkats, helping persuade them to convert. Henry spoke as part of Sealaska Heritage Institute's lecture series for Native American Awareness Month. His talk was titled 19th Century Encounters Between Natives and Non-Natives in Chilkat Country, or alternatively,
Trampling the Shaman, Disease, Guns, Money, Booze, John Muir, and the Conversion of the Chilkats.
The Chilkats, who inhabited Upper Lynn Canal during the 18th and 19th centuries, have been called the most warlike heathen indigenous people on the continent, so their conversion by white settlers has baffled historians for decades.
What happened that you had a group of people who were so fierce and so warlike and so feared by not only white people but by other Tlingit people, that suddenly, or apparently suddenly, over a fairly short period of time, they became civilized, quote-unquote.
As with other Native people who converted, Henry says many factors contributed to the Chilkats' embrace of Christianity. That includes the spread of smallpox, firearms, and alcohol in the region during the mid-19th century. But he says the turning point was a tent revival organized by missionary S. Hall Young near Klukwan in November 1879. John Muir just happened to be with Young on his way to study the geology of Glacier Bay and Lynn Canal. During the tent revival, Muir reluctantly spoke about his research into glaciers and a little bit about the Brotherhood of Man.
He showed them that he was the same as them. For once, and I asked Kim Strong this, who is the IRA president up in Klukwan, I said, what was it about John Muir that suddenly converted your people? And she said, he was the first man we'd ever met who didn't want something from us.
Henry is currently writing a book about land use confrontation in Upper Lynn Canal communities.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
The population of the endangered western stock of Steller sea lions seems to be stabilizing overall. Sea lion population data presented this week to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's groundfish management team showed that the pup numbers increased by an average of 1% per year since 1998. However, Alaska Fisheries Science Center Director Doug DeMaster says that number is smaller than it should be and is not statistically significant.
That's a pretty small rate of increase. This is a population that, you know, that should be doing 5 to 8% per year, and if it were recovering at its kind of maximum rate. So 1% per year, you know, that's better than declining, but it's not a statistically significant rate of increase. So we would have to say that since the late 1990s, there's been no significant trend in abundance, but that means it's stable. But at least it doesn't appear to be declining.
The numbers work out to be about 8 more pups per rookery per year in the Western stock. Combining that information with other data, that means 2 more females per year survive to breeding age in each of the 31 rookeries. Sea lion biologist Lowell Fritz says that's better than no increase, but the population certainly isn't out of the woods yet, especially when you look at the different subregions. DeMaster agrees.
But again, we're very concerned that the different areas are responding differently, and in particular, that Western Aleutian area appears not to be recovering.
In the central part of the Stellar Sea Lion Range near Unalaska and the western part of the Gulf of Alaska, the population grew at about 3 to 4% per year from 2005 to 2009. Near Kodiak, it was more like 2%. Fritz says the population in the far western region is declining at about 10% per year, and one rookery is on the verge of extinction. DeMaster says no one knows why the western subregion population is still declining. Unlike other sea lion groups, their major food source is Atka mackerel, which is commercially fished, but it is not known if this is related to the decline. Other populations feed on pollock, which is also fished. It's uncertain what caused the overall species decline as well, but some data points to problems with reproduction.
For some reason, reproduction in these stellars appears to be 30, 40, 50% lower than what we would expect.
The National Marine Fisheries Service will need to determine whether or not the federally managed commercial fisheries are negatively impacting the stellar sea lion populations, and if so, what to do about it. Currently, boats are restricted from fishing within 10 miles from most rookeries and haulouts and 20 miles from others. In March, NIMS will review a draft biological opinion on the status of the western population of stellar sea lions and decide if further restrictions are needed. The eastern population of stellar sea lions, which stretches from southeast Alaska to California, is increasing at about 5% per year. Maggie, the elephant's famous treadmill, has a new home. Big Lake musher Martin Boozer acquired the massive piece of equipment after the elephant left for new digs in California. The treadmill was supposed to help her get exercise during the long Alaska winter, but her trainer at the Alaska Zoo wasn't able to get her to use it. Boozer is housing it in a large barn at his Happy Trails kennel. He has plenty of ideas for using it to help train his 60 dogs, but it's not operational yet.
If you're a pachyderm, of course, you don't go to the local grocery store or the local fitness store and get yourself a treadmill. You know, everything was custom-made for Maggie's ever-growing girth. 9,000 pounds was her estimated weight at the time. So it was especially a custom-made treadmill that probably weighed up to 16,000 pounds when it was all assembled for Maggie's purposes. We were able to strip off quite a few pounds and make it somewhat more maneuverable. I'm still looking for some parts and pieces to make it more user-friendly. I'm not going to use three-phase power. I'm not going to need the 75-horse electric motor. So maybe some of your listeners might be willing to do some horse trading or some elephant trading, as it were, for a smaller electric motor and maybe some more cable. I'm looking for some 300 or 400 foot of variable cable to power the building and all that kind of stuff. But it's substantial. The dimensions are basically 22 foot of running track and a 5 foot wide belt.
Wow. Did it seem like a good idea right away when you thought about this, or did you have to really kind of mull it over for a while?
No, you know, I'm kind of crazy about my dogs anyway, and I had actually messed around with treadmills years and years ago. I would go to the local thrift stores, and I would buy the discarded treadmills. I put some of them on angles so they were actually self-motivated, self-propelled. I would have some electronically driven, but they always had, with puppies and electronics and belts and parts, of course, that's an unhappy combination. They're always chewing on stuff that they're not supposed to be chewing. Then, of course, I came up with the big gerbil wheels. I have now 8, 9, or 10-foot gerbil wheels in my puppy pens, and they are truly a blast. The dogs absolutely love them. They hop in, run around at their leisure as much as they want. So as soon as the discussion came up that Maggie needed the treadmill, I was drooling and dreaming that I should have a budget like that or sponsors like that and come up with a doggy treadmill for me that incorporated a building and the size that would be conducive for more than just one or two dogs.
And Mr. Boozer, what are you hoping the treadmill will accomplish for your training with the dogs that you can't do without it?
Every day I keep thinking of new, interesting things that we could be doing. You know, on a 40 or 50 below day, we're not going to go out and run dogs because the net gain is probably zero, if not a loss. So a treadmill that can house, you know, 16 or 18 dogs at one time could come in handy. You could actually thermal control the building, and instead of having it 40 below, you put a little heat in there, and you got it at zero. Ideal for the drivers as well as the dogs.
And what about the maintenance and upkeep? Are you worried that it might be expensive to maintain it?
Yeah, it's cost me over $20,000 so far, you know. Everything we do is done for the dogs. MEA right now is trying to configure my treadmill to a little cheaper operating cost. So we're coming up with different ways, but I must also say that right now that project is kind of frozen simply because I'm already spending, you know, plenty of time out on the trail. But we keep dedicating some time, but I can't lose sight of the big picture. And the big picture, of course, is to train the dogs into superb shape, the what I call, quote-unquote, old-fashioned way with sleds and harnesses and hope to win the Iditarod yet one more time.
Martin Boozer is a four-time Iditarod champ who lives at Big Lake. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by the Alaska Wounded Veterans Project, a nonprofit organization that provides assistance to veterans who were wounded both physically and psychologically during the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Information at alaskastateelks.org. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.